You're listening to the Sober Living Rocks podcast. I'm Esther Nagel, your host, and today I'm speaking with Ria Bochner. Ria is a writer, musician, and mother. She has worn many hats in her lifetime, including a tour guide at Disney World's Great Movie Ride, a story developer at Universal Studios, a special educator, a doula, and once a kids' yoga instructor whose class was sabotaged by her own children. She holds a BA in film and screenwriting from Emerson College and an MA in special education from Montclair State University. Ria's articles and short stories have appeared in a variety of publications, including the New York Times best-selling Small Miracles series. Her short series, Exodus, Zella's Dry Goods and Hardware, and The Mustache Orchard were all featured in anthologies published by Mosaica Press. She spun her beguiling early years of parenthood into a series entitled Parentology, How to Raise Happy, Healthy Babies Without Losing Your Mind. She lives in New Jersey with her husband, five children and three cats. The Cape House is her debut memoir. Do you feel trapped and alone, stuck behind the mask alcohol gives you to get through life? Do you worry that sobriety would give you no coping strategies for those tough times and leave you further isolated in a boring, joyless life? The Sober Living Rocks podcast is here to show you that sobriety can be a joyful, transformational journey to a life of growth, truth, connection and inner peace. Join me, Esther Nagel, and my guests as we explore the gift sobriety brings and the tools we use to get us there. Welcome, Ria, and thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
You've got a fascinating story to tell there. I can just tell with just those few sentences that I've just read out that this is going to be a really interesting story with your interesting career background.
Indeed.
And I love the title of your book, How to Raise Happy, Healthy Babies Without Losing Your Mind as well.
I lost my mind, so I just, it's more like, you know, I did it for everybody else. I took one for the team, you know?
Very kind of you.
I'll allow everyone else to do it with some serenity.
Oh, that's brilliant. With five children, are they all very close in age?
So I have two stepdaughters who are 15 and 14. They're in and out. They come every other weekend. And then I have three little boys who are with us full time. One is 8. One will be 7 in a month. He will tell you directly. And I have a 3.5-year-old also.
So, oh, very close then.
Very busy household.
Very busy. Yeah. Wow.
Basically, my days are just one long game of whack-a-mole. You know, whoever pops up, I just have to, you know, knock them back down.
I love it. Yes, I've got one, and he's enough. I've got one in the house with me now. I've got three, but I've got one in the house with me now, and he's enough. So, gosh, I take my hat off to you. Two around about the same age as him. Are they Pokemon and Minecraft obsessed?
Oh my gosh, Pokemon. If I ever meet the inventor of Pokemon, I take no responsibility for what I do to that person.
Yeah, I join you.
Oh, goodness. And you know there are mothers everywhere being like, I don't know, damage, you know, like, what does that mean? How many? And like, I'll be making dinner and my 7-year-old will come in and be like, what's 280 minus 130? And I'm like, why are you asking me these random math questions? He's like, I need to know how much damage I'll do. I need to know how much health. And I'm like, I don't know. I haven't done math in like 10 years. I have no idea. Go ask your father.
And the inventors of Pokemon would say it's a really good thing because it's helping him with his maths.
Yeah, this is probably true.
It doesn't stop us from losing our minds, though, does it?
Yeah, exactly. At the cost of my sanity, my child is now a math genius.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, that's, Pokemon is, my son has fortunately gone off playing the game on my phone. Mm-hmm. But he's now completely obsessed. He'll read about it. He's got it on a Nintendo at his father's house. And that is all I ever hear about.
Yep.
And he tells me it as if I know what he's talking about.
Right. They start asking me, like, which one would you be? I'm like, I don't know. The blue one? Like,
yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah, whichever one's purple, I'll be that one.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be whoever's blue. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sure we could talk about the trials and tribulations of being a Pokemon mum for hours on end. But
yeah, that's a podcast in and of itself.
It is, really, isn't it? Yeah, that's for the Parenting Without Losing Your Mind podcast.
Exactly.
But the reason we're here today talking is because of your experience of addiction and your amazing journey through that and through an awful lot of other things that you've had to deal with, and you're sharing your story not just here today but in your book The Cape House, which has come out 6 weeks ago. And I started reading it, and I'm really looking forward to being able to sit down and actually read it rather than just quickly reading it and then thinking, oh, I've got lots of work to do. But I'm going to sit down one Sunday when I don't have anything else to do and read that. It looks amazing. And I think I'm going to need a box of tissues next to me as I'm reading it. So would you like to tell the listeners of the podcast, if you take some time to tell your story, and, you know, how you come to be here today?
Yes, it would be my pleasure.
Okay.
So I guess my story actually starts at when I was 6 months old. There's a video of me when I was a baby, and I'm sitting in a high chair between my parents, and they have this big container of Dairy Queen. I don't know if they have Dairy Queen in England, but it's like a soft serve ice cream place. So basically, I'm sitting in my high chair, and my parents are sharing this giant Dairy Queen and spooning it into their mouths, and I'm watching them with some curiosity. So, and they have this video camera like running on the three of us. So my mother puts a spoonful of ice cream into my mouth, and you can see my eyes light up. It's like I'm a winning slot machine. Like my whole face just transformed with this bite of ice cream. And for the next 10 minutes, I was grunting at my parents, like, like, give me more of this. And, you know, my parents are laughing because it's cute, right? You know, 6 months old, wanting more ice cream, whatever. And over the next 10 minutes, as this video is going, I watched them like continue to feed me. And I'm like, how did I not throw up? Like, I just kept eating the ice cream. And, you know, at the time it's a cute video, but it really, for me, is like, there's no question that from the very beginning, I had a problem with food. From the time I was around 5, it became something that was in my consciousness that I was different from other kids in the way that they related with food. I was the only kid I knew who dug pizza crusts out of garbage cans after other kids had thrown them out. I was the only kid who stole snacks from other kids' lunchboxes. And I thought it was strange that I was constantly thinking about what I was going to be eating. I always categorized any place I was going by what I could eat there. You know, my memories of the synagogue I used to go to as a kid was what they served at they call it a kiddush, which is like a little like cocktail hour after the services. I always thought about like the cookies, like that. It was how I categorized my life, was what I could eat. So by the time I was 8 years old, cause I was constantly eating, you know, I would have breakfast and go to school and eat my food at school, come home, snack. And from the time I got home, have dinner with my family and then continue eating. It was like I had that off switch that people have when they're full, for me was broken. So by the time I was 8 years old, I was overweight. And so at 10, I started my first round of commercial dieting. So this is kind of where my mother's and my stories, I mean, obviously they intersected from the very beginning when I was born, but our stories in terms of addiction and that, how that affected our relationship, really started to intersect there. Because my mother was not an overweight woman. I should rephrase that. She wasn't a fat woman. She was a big woman. But when I say big, I don't mean big in that euphemistic way. I mean, my mother was tall and she was broad. She had a very solid figure, but it wasn't that you would look at her and think of her as like a giantess or anything. She just was a very strong, charismatic personality. And so she took space. She walked into a room and you immediately, your eyes went to her. She was just a presence. And so in her eyes, you know, she reached 5'8" by the time she was 13 years old. So in her head, she always thought she was huge. And she had a sister who was older than her who was very petite. And so she always thought of herself as this giant person who needed to lose weight. If you looked at her, she looked like an average person. But in her eyes, that's how she saw herself. And so she always was on some kind of diet or trying to lose weight or whatever. So that was in the background of my consciousness. But it was so much more obviously a need for me because I was actually fat. And so when I was about 10, my mother and I started our first commercial diet together. And we went through all of them, all the popular brand name diets that everybody knows, you know, the counting and the you buy food at the beginning of the week and you eat it all and whatever. The problem was because I had this reaction to food that is specifically certain foods like flour and sugar, where if I would eat them, I couldn't stop eating them. I could never succeed at these diets because a normal person who doesn't eat like me could just eat the food, exercise a little, lose weight, and that's it. You know, there's nothing wrong with diet programs. I'm sure they work for some people, but for a food addict like me, they just never worked. But the problem was, aside from the fact that they didn't work and how disheartening that was for me, I was doing it with my mother. So I felt like a failure every time I fell off the wagon, as it were. And, you know, it was just, you know, I felt like I needed to hide it from her, felt like I needed to apologize for it. And like, we would report our food to each other and what we were eating. And like, listen, my mother adored me and all she wanted to do was help, but it wasn't healthy. It just, you know, we both wanted me to do what needed to be done. But neither of us knew that, like, you can't fix someone with an addiction. You know, the addict can't, you know, if you don't know you have an addiction, there's nothing really you can do to fix it. And a person besides the addict certainly can't fix it. So anyway, this continued for a while. And my mother was, you know, in her capacity was unbelievably supportive, you know, just really, she was in so much pain for me and wanted to do everything she could to help me. But the weight kept creeping up. When I was 14, by the time I was 14, I weighed about 225 pounds. And my mother and I spent a month. She went away with me for a month to one of the foremost diet centers, diet and fitness centers in the entire country. And while we were there, they would do these lectures about, you know, caloric intake versus metabolic output. Basically, like, how to lose weight 101, which, like, if you look at somebody who's severely overweight, I can guarantee you they probably know more about food and nutrition than a professional nutritionist, because we're constantly counting calories. We constantly are looking at what we're eating. It's just that we can't stop eating it. And so, you know, when they're saying to me, eat less and exercise more and you'll lose weight, this is nothing I hadn't heard before. And so there was one day I raised my hand and I said to them, you know, what happens if there's something in my kitchen that's talking to me and I can't not eat it? And they looked at me like I had five heads. And they were like, what do you mean? Just don't eat it. And I'm like, no, just don't eat it is not one of those options. It will get eaten at some point. It's just a question of when. So, you know, that was very disheartening because I thought maybe the medical profession had a magic pill that would somehow fix this thing for me. But it just got worse and worse. And at 16, I fell into bulimia. You know, I've since learned in my years in relating with people with eating disorders is that many, obviously not all, but many anorexics and bulimics start as food addicts first and then fall onto those eating disorders as sort of a backup plan, as damage control, which for me, that was my experience. I knew that I couldn't stop eating and I knew that the weight was going to keep creeping up, but I thought that if I purged after I ate, maybe I could control the weight from going up. I had already resolved with myself the fact that I would never be a thin person, but at least I wouldn't go any higher because by then I was 250 and I knew that 300 was there. And in my head, I had resolved that if I ever saw 300 on the scale, I would kill myself. And so I knew it was there and I knew there was really nothing I could do to stop it. And so I started purging. So, and for me, I guess I'm lucky in that I'm a very quick bottom. I hit my bottom in my disease at 19 years old, And I went from 0 times to vomiting eight times a day within a matter of like 3 months, 3-4 months. So, you know, things moved quickly for me. And my sister, with whom I shared a bathroom, I thought I was, you know, being very secretive, which I was. Most people didn't know what was going on, but my sister knew, obviously, because we shared a bathroom. And she went to my mother and told her what was going on. And my mother had an intervention with me and told me that I couldn't throw up anymore. And I told her that I hated her for that, because, like, I finally found this thing that I could control everything with. I didn't care if it was dangerous. I didn't care if it would kill me. Like, you know, and there was a point where I, during one of my purges, where I almost choked to death. But I didn't care, because for me, if, like, you know, continuing to gain weight and to become more and more obese was a much worse fate than that. But long story short, I ended up stopping for a little while until I graduated high school, because I was still at home and my mother was watching me like a hawk. And in the meantime, you know, we talked to each other about, you know, what we were eating, what we weren't eating, when I would get more disappointed or just crestfallen, you know, if I'd audition for a play. And I was into theater, and I was very good, but I was always given like the old woman part, or like the funny sidekick part, never the ingenue, because I didn't look like the ingenue. Even though I could probably, you know, I could sing beautifully and could be the ingenue, I didn't look like one, so I never got that part. And there were days, like after auditions, I would go home and sit on my mother's bed and cry. And she would just sit there and be like, I wish I could fix it for you. I wish I could fix it for you. And so I got to college, and when I was on my own, things just bombed for me very quickly. I traveled around Europe a little bit, and my disease really took off, because I didn't have any, it was just me on my own, and I had no capacity to control myself. Things just got worse and worse and worse for me. And I ended up at 19 finding a 12-step recovery group that helps people with eating issues. And I don't remember how I first heard about them, but the way that I got to my first meeting is funny. So I went to film school in Boston at Emerson College, and I was working on a screenplay about the diet industry. I thought I could write this big expose about like diets, and if I could like prove that they were total bunk, then everybody would forgive me for being obese. Like, you know, like that was my big plan. So I called my mother in New Jersey, and I said to her, you know, I heard about this group of people, this group of fat people, because this was what I decided it was, a group of fat people who get together every week and talk about food. So I want you to go to their meeting and listen to what they say and call me back so I could put it in my screenplay. And she, you know, being my codependent sidekick, was like, okay. So she went to the meeting and she called me back and she said, I think you should go. You should check it out. So I was, you know, 19 years old. It was a rainy Tuesday in Boston and freezing outside. And I was like, well, I got nothing else to do today except, you know, like contemplate suicide. So I might as well go to a meeting, this meeting that was down the block from my dormitory. Like, there was no excuse for me not to go. So I walk up Tremont Street to this church and go in. And I look in, and there's just like a bunch of random people sitting around a table. And they weren't fat, like maybe two of them out of the dozen or so people that were there. And at first I was like, is this the right place? Whatever. So I go in, and there's this list of big poster with a list of 12 steps on it. And these people are just kind of talking about like what's going on with them. And I was so confused. Remember, I'm like a product of a parade of professional diet clubs. So like, I'm waiting for someone to weigh me. I'm waiting for someone to like give me the food I'm supposed to buy. I'm waiting for someone to give me like a ribbon or a chip or something. And nobody said anything except come sit down. So I did. And I listened to these people. I had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. It was like, I was so confused. But there was a person there who, after the person who was sharing said something, and another person in the group said, hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm a compulsive overeater. And when they said that, it was like, zing, like a light bulb went off in my brain. Like, I don't know exactly what a compulsive overeater is, but I'm that. I have no idea, like, that, there's a name for that. Like, and it was a revelation because, oh my gosh, there's a name for this thing. That means it's a thing. Like, it's an actual thing. And I'm not the only person with that thing. And so even though I had no idea what they were doing there or what this whole thing was about, I got the sense that if I said to these people, I can't not eat that, they would totally get what I meant. And so for the next 2 years, I kept going to meetings. The problem is, though, if you keep going to meetings and listening to people and hearing that they have a solution, but you're not doing it, it takes all the fun out of eating. And so I went into a major, I wouldn't even call it a relapse. I just like, I had to do some research and development into, you know, compulsive overeating to make sure I really knew what it was. And things got really dark for me for a little while. I when you read in my bio that I worked at Disney and at Universal, that was actually during the worst of my compulsive eating. So they were both amazing opportunities, but I wasn't really there for them. I was busy like binging and purging, and it was a really dark time in my life. And so when I graduated college, I had very little prospects. I could barely function. I'm one of those people, you know, there are plenty of high functioning addicts, high functioning alcoholics, high functioning compulsive overeaters. I'm not one of them. I'm one of those people who, when I'm in it, I call out sick to work. I stay in my pajamas. I don't shower for days, and I just eat food. That's basically it. And people who don't have this disease do not understand that, but it's a thing. It's a thing. So after I graduated, I moved home because I really had nothing else to do. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any career prospects. I mean, after you graduate film school, you're basically qualified to make movies and wait tables. And I didn't want to do either. So I moved home to my parents' house. I moved into their basement. They had like an apartment situation down there. So I moved down there. And basically was rotting away in their basement. I got a job as a teacher's aide and was just eating, you know, going to work, coming home, eating, watching movies, and going to sleep. And that was my life. But I kept going to meetings because I really, you know, I wanted to get better. Ironically, around the time that I started going to meetings, my mother started going to meetings too. And right away, she got abstinent. In the 12-step program that I'm a part of, they call refraining from compulsive overeating as abstinence. And so she got abstinent and she dropped 50 pounds and she was so happy. And she was full of energy and really just flying high. And meanwhile, I'm like going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. So one night, I went to a meeting, with women who had what I wanted. You know, they had, some of them had lost 200 pounds and had been maintaining the loss for 20 years. You know, they really, and they had lives, you know, they had kids, they had marriages, they had jobs, they had things to do besides watch videos and eat, you know? And so they talked about how they did it and what they did to maintain it. And all of a sudden the wires crossed in my brain and it was like, maybe if I do what they do, I'll have what they have. And it's like A plus B equals C, right? But like, it took me 2 years to either see it or be willing or whatever the point was, like that was when the clouds opened up for me and I got clean that night. And that was March 29th, 2004. So 13 years ago, 2 days ago. So basically after that, I started, you know, I got clean and I started eating abstinently. And over the next year and a half, I got thin. I lost over 100 pounds. And, you know, and I think even not just obese people think this, but I think that particularly for the obese, I had a dream about the word thin. The word thin encompassed all my hopes and dreams of what life was going to be once I got there. You know, my life was going to look like a Reese Witherspoon romantic comedy where everything was pastel and everybody was happy and she had a fabulous apartment that no actual person can really afford in Manhattan. And like, you know what I mean? Like life was going to be fabulous and I would have no problems and everything would be wonderful. So yeah. I got to thin and it turned out I was just a jerk. You know, around the time that I got abstinent, my mother lost her abstinence and she relapsed. And so, you know, she was abstinent and I wasn't, she was constantly eating her heart out about the fact that she wanted me to get better. Well, when the roles were reversed, I was just totally superior. And like, yeah, see, I'm blah, 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 and I'm so abstinent and you're not abstinent. Oh, God, I was such a jerk. But anyway, I really thought that being a thin person excused me and absolved me from any inappropriate behavior. I could treat people how I wanted to because I'm thin and pretty now. That's how the world works. But eventually I moved out on my own and I discovered that the loneliness and the anxiety and the fear that followed me around when I was obese hadn't gone away with those 100 pounds. I still felt that rage simmering right under my skin all the time. And I still felt anxious and terrified and lonely. And I found myself alone a lot because my primary relationship had always been with food. So I didn't really know how to relate with people. I just related with people like I related with food. So I would, you know, eat them metaphorically or, you know, smoke them or whatever. And when I was done, I would throw them out. And then I'd wonder, why am I alone? Why am I hurting? Why are they hurting? And it finally got to a point where, you know, I walked back into the rooms. Not that I had ever left my meetings, but I went to people who had serenity and had a spiritual experience. And I went to them and I said, tell me what to do and I'll do it because I can't live like this. I'd rather be fat and at least have some kind of buffer than be thin and as miserable as this. Because life was supposed to be perfect when I'm thin, but it turns out it's a lot more complicated because now I have nothing to hide behind. So I started working the 12 steps and as directed to me, and really started looking at the truth about myself, about the damage that I'd caused and how selfishness had really pervaded my life. It was like, you know, I had this disease, which I fed and then expected the world to like applaud for me for being a functional human being. It's like, no, you know, I'm no better than anybody else. Nobody else is better than me. We're all just trying to get through this thing together. You know, a lot of the resentment I had against my mother that really damaged our relationship was because I thought that it was her job to fix me and she thought it was her job to fix me. But it turned out that, you know, she was just doing the best she could. And now that I'm a parent, I have so much empathy for her. I have no idea. No, now I do know. And now I do have an idea of how hard it must have been for her to watch me kill myself and not be able to do anything about it. Eventually I was able to really see my part, and I had this person who was guiding me at the time, my sponsor. I had said to her, you know, eventually I was writing, you know, my inventory and seeing the same behaviors over and over again to the point where I was disgusted with myself. And I called this person and I said to her, like, why do I have to keep looking at this over and over? This is like making me nauseous. I can't look at it anymore. And she said to me, you know, think about those days when people used to hang their sheets on clotheslines outside. And when you hang the sheet enough times in the sun, the patterns fade. And she said, that's what we're doing here. Patterns fade in the sunlight. And so that really made a huge difference in my life. And so finally I went to my mother and I made amends to her, and things really shifted for us afterward because I was able to just say, you know, we're just two people trying to get through this thing. And mind you, like, you know, there's always that mother-daughter stuff, that normal mother-daughter stuff that never goes away, but that's intrinsic of the relationship. You know, we want to be independent, but we look to our mothers for that validation that we all need and that sense of identity that we're looking for, even though we want to do it ourselves. But like, daughters need our mothers. It's just how it is. And that's okay. And we ended up really, I mean, we were always close, but it became a much healthier close. And I eventually got married and we got pregnant. And about right at the tail end of my first trimester, my mother called me and told me that she had cancer. So I was living 15 minutes from her apartment, and I was working as a teacher at the time. So while I was pregnant with my first child, I would go to work, drive across the George Washington Bridge, and go hang out with her in her apartment maybe 3 days a week while she was going through chemo. And we just hung out, and I cooked for her, and we watched The Holiday with Kate Winslet 8,000 times. She's my favorite, Kate Winslet. And we just talked. And, you know, I would say to her, I feel really scared about being a mother. And she would always say to me, don't worry, when you see the baby's face, your whole life is going to change. She would say that over and over again. But being pregnant with my mom sick was really scary because first time pregnancy is already scary, but, you know, it was terrifying. So one day, there was a day that came where my mother was between chemo and a surgery, and chemo really knocked my mother down for the count. She was the kind of person who like would take Tylenol and have a hangover. Like, you know, so chemo really did a number on her. But she fought really hard. You know, she fought to see her grandson born. She fought to see my brother get married. She, you know, she came to my brother's wedding. She had to switch her dress because the port that was in her chest, the original dress she bought before she got sick, was pushing into it. So she had to get a backup dress. But she was there. She looked really pale, but she was at my brother's wedding. But anyway, so one day between the chemo and the surgery, my dad had to go on a business trip. And so she came to my house. And because she didn't have the chemo in her system, she had energy again, which was really exciting. So we went out shopping, of course, because that's what we did. And we got all this baby stuff. And she and my husband got the crib together. And she looked at the nursery after it was done. And she's like, okay, now you're ready to have a baby. And that night I went into labor. And so, you know, I think I wanted to have the baby then because I knew she was there. It was the time that I knew. Anyway, long story short, we had my son. And when he was about 7 months old, we had moved by that point up to my family's house in Cape Cod. And my mother called me from New York. She was getting treatment at Sloan Kettering in New York City, and she said that the cancer had spread, and they found a nodule in her lung, and it was terminal cancer, and she didn't have very long to live. So she wanted to come up to the family, to the Cape House where we were. For her last however long she had. So she and my father moved up there, and my whole family moved into the house. I have two brothers and a sister, and they moved in with their significant others. And my husband was there with our oldest, and I took care of her with my father and my siblings. And during that stretch, I made Passover for everyone, and you know, found myself in a situation I never expected myself to be in ever. But because I had grown up because of my experience in recovery, because I had gotten the tools of how to deal with life, I showed up. And because we had come to that place of real understanding with each other, there was nothing unresolved. We were able to just be and just show up for it. And of course it was harrowing, but there was also something really beautiful about it. And it was an opportunity, you know. That's the thing with all these ugly blessings that life gives you is that there are hidden gems in them, that they show you what you're made of. You get to see strengths in yourself you didn't know you had. And it's a time in my life that it's like this little cocoon of time. It was only 6 weeks, but it was life-changing. And it really made me. If that and recovery are the two defining experiences in my life. Motherhood also, but in a different way. But when my mother called me that day, she called me and said that she was sick. You know, I've been a writer for a long time. When I had my oldest child, I quit teaching and decided to write full time so I could be with him. And I've been doing that ever since so I could be home with my other sons also. So the day she called me, I started writing. I didn't know, I was just notes. It was like a journal, but I knew I had to record what was going on as it was going on. I had the sense that this was something really important. And I wrote every single day from that day until the last day that we had sat Shiva. So that's like a week after she passed away. And I had these notes that I just sort of poked at and edited and looked at and put away for a while. And over the next 8 years, between having my other kids and moving and, you know, life, I cobbled a book together. I turned it into a book. I wrote the story of, when my mother was still sick, she asked me to write her story. So I wrote the part about her being sick, which she had asked me to, but I found that our relationship became a really important backdrop of this story and how basically she had saved my life, and that I wouldn't have, like, everything that I went through with my addiction and my recovery, I probably wouldn't have survived it without her. And so that story really tied into the end, to what happened with us together, so that I could be with her for the end. And that product is the Cape House. And we released it on her birthday this year, February 16th. And it was something of which I am extremely proud. Not only because I started something and finished it, but because it's a tribute to her. It really, you know, we don't often see what people do for us until afterward. We don't see the impact they have on us. And it was an opportunity to really look back and see how all those pieces fit together. Both our illness and recovery and how she shaped me. And so it's been a real gift. The whole experience was a real gift, and it's brought a lot of blessing into my life. Because I really, you know, part of my writing the book, aside from honoring my mother's request, is as an act of service. I really wanted to, you know, I didn't have a support network when my mother was ill. I didn't really have, there weren't a lot of books out there that tell you what it's like to love someone with cancer or to be in that, those last weeks where things are really intense. And I wish I had had something like that. So I wanted people who are going through that to see what it looked like. And at the same time, I really also wanted to talk about food addiction, because, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction are very much common parlance at this point, but not everybody realizes that food addiction is a thing. It's really a thing. And it's just as real as any of those other addictions, and equally as insidious. And so I really wanted to raise awareness about that. So that's my story.
Wow, what a story. I don't know if you noticed, you can see me like wiping my eyes at one point. It's getting quite well, what an incredible story. And you tell it with such humor as well. I mean, I had my microphone muted, but there were many times when you were making me laugh quite a lot through the telling of that story as well. And so I am definitely looking forward to reading your book now after hearing your story from you as well. I'm gonna read it tonight. I'm gonna switch my laptop off and I'm gonna put my Kindle on. And you're absolutely right. I mean, food addiction. You know, there's so much that we could talk about after this, but food addiction is. It's so difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, if you're an alcoholic, I stopped drinking. I could stop. Yeah. I could cut it out of my life completely. I could cut cigarettes out. I could cut drugs out. You can't cut food out of your life. And when most people see an overweight person, there's massive judgments that they make about that person. And I know I've been guilty of that myself, because we just do. Yeah. We're told that if somebody's fat, it's because they're lazy and they're greedy.
Right. They brought it on themselves.
And they brought it on themselves. And, you know, I know now, because I've looked into it, but most people don't know that actually it's something that you are not in control of. That it's not just that you're thinking, I'm going to eat all these because I want to eat them all. It's just that you absolutely cannot stop until it's gone.
Funny. Like when doctors say to people with, you know, and obviously there are people who don't have this problem, but if you say to someone with food addiction, you know, just lose weight and you'll get healthier, they don't realize that, like, it's not that they don't want to, it's that they can't.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
Telling someone to not have cancer anymore, you know, you can't.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, As you were saying, you know, I was thinking in the book I talk about how people regard anorexics and bulimics as like, oh, poor them, they're sick, you know. But if you look at somebody with obesity, it's like a moral failing, like a, you know, the lack of willpower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're subhuman. Their vices, you know, took them over, and we live in a very fat shaming society, and so it's hard to explain to people that this isn't just somebody, you know. This is a lack of choice. This is a lack of power. Just like you look at an alcoholic who can't stop drinking, it's the same exact thing.
It is, yeah. And you're absolutely right. I mean, we're in the kind of society now where even somebody who is not actually fat can be considered obese and can be made to feel that they're fat, that, you know, because we get these ridiculous images thrust upon us of what we're supposed to look like. And, you know, we know logically, you know, that model doesn't actually look like that, that she's been stretched and narrowed and, you know, the photoshopping that goes on. But when you see it, your emotions tell you that's what I should look like. And I don't look like that. Therefore, I'm not as good as her. And it affects everyone. And children, you know, we get little girls wanting to be skinny, thin. And
oh, yeah. One of my good friends and I were, her daughter is 5. And she was wearing pajamas the other day, and my friend pointed out, said, look at how tight those pajamas are. And they're like size, whatever size her daughter was. She said, like, my daughter wears that size. They're cutting them small. Like, they're cutting them. I'm like, I know. They're like priming these girls for eating disorders. Like, they're cutting them tight.
To make them feel like they're fat. Yeah.
Really disturbing.
Yeah.
Really disturbing.
It is. It's really frightening. Yeah.
And it, you know, it all ties into that for all these eating disorders. You know, people who are looking at these unattainable goals and trying to morph themselves into an ideal that really doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Like, there may be 4 people on the planet that look like that. And the truth is, as someone who got to, listen, I'm no model, but like, I got to a place that, you know, is quote unquote, I wore a size 2. I was tiny, you know, not anymore. I had 3 babies, so that's over. But like, you know, I got to a size 2 and my life was supposed to be perfect, right? Everything was supposed to be great. And it really did nothing except change the size of my jeans. That's about it, you know?
Yeah.
It was a big lesson of my whole life that, like, the thing that I really wanted, the thing that I was looking for, was an inside job. It had absolutely nothing to do with what I looked like on the outside.
And that's the lesson that is, it's the ultimate lesson to learn, really, isn't it? We're told by the world around us that you know, happiness lies out there. Happiness lies in some ideal. Happiness lies in you not being who you are right now.
Right.
It's always, you've got to be something else. You've got to be better. You've got to be thinner. You've got to be richer. You've got to be more. You've got to be more. And then you get all that. And then there's still more and more. You think, ah. And then it clicks then. Actually, if I can just be happy the way I am now, then I can be happy.
I mean, that's like, you know, people look at are confused when celebrities go overdose and are dealing with all the, you know, I read this great book by Mary Pfeiffer. She wrote Reviving Ophelia, excuse me. It was like a big book in the 90s about eating disorders. But she wrote a book a few years ago called Seeking Peace. And basically she talked about how after Reviving Ophelia came out, it was a huge bestseller. And all of a sudden, before this had happened, she was like, you know, she was a therapist with a small practice in Nebraska. And all of a sudden, she's this huge best-selling author, and she's traveling to all these different cities and doing all these book tours, and people are coming to her and talking to her, whatever. And she had a nervous breakdown because she had been calibrated to have this very small, simple life. And all of a sudden, she felt the need to please all of these people who were coming to her and needing something from her, and she couldn't be everything for everyone. And she said, I totally understand now why celebrities can't hack it, because it's too much. And so, you know, we live in a society where celebrity and fame and wealth are this ultimate goal, and yet you see people who have all those things and are miserable because of these external accomplishments that offer you no inner peace.
And maybe they've lost a little bit, you know, like the musician. I mean, Kurt Cobain popped into my head. So at some point in his life, Kurt Cobain maybe would have just been happy with a guitar in his bedroom, writing songs, and he would have got through his life had he not suddenly been propelled onto this world stage where the thing that maybe made his life joyful suddenly became this huge weight of expectations on him. And it is. And you people think, oh, well, they've got all this money, they must be happy. But no, it doesn't. It's not about money. It's not about things at all. It's,
Which is like one of the big lessons of my life, because even I'm into geographical cures. So like I'm constantly on real estate sites because I think that if I have a really pretty house, then everything's gonna be great. You know, I say like men have penis envy and women have kitchen envy. So like, you know, that I kind of ogle other people's houses. But you know, I've moved a number of times in my marriage, and I've still been in all of those locations that I went to, you know, like I was still there. So, you know, it didn't go away.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. I found that like since finishing the book, this book was really a huge project that was on my back burner for 8 years. And since finishing it, a lot of those needs to be elsewhere have really dissipated. Because I guess when you're cultivating your soul purpose and you're depositing into your inner bank, like you don't need to be looking elsewhere. Mind you, I'm still totally addicted to like social media, but you know, I think that just sort of, I'm on the rank of a normal human being, but like, you know, I feel like that restlessness is not there as much, you know. Everybody is born with something and born to do something. And I feel like if you're on the path to the thing that you're supposed to be doing, why do you need to be somewhere else?
That's really good. That sort of stopped me in my tracks, you saying that, actually, because I still live in the place I grew up. I tried to leave and I failed miserably, and I came back and I haven't been able to leave. And I keep saying, I gotta leave, I gotta leave, I gotta leave, but I'm still here. And maybe that's it. Maybe I'm doing what I'm meant to do. So I've got mountains around me, I've got the coast an hour away, so maybe I don't need to be anywhere else.
Yeah,
I just need to go on holiday a bit more often so I can get the sun a bit more.
Oh, me too. Take me with you. Oh my gosh. I'm like, I say to my husband, we live in New Jersey, and I said to him, as soon as we can we just please go somewhere with sunshine? Winter is a joke. I'm like, I can't.
Yeah, it's very grey and wet here at the moment. I really miss the sunshine.
Well, that's England for you. I mean, although I'll tell you, when I lived in Holland, I found that winter, like the weather in general in Europe, is a lot milder than it is in America. It doesn't go to as much extreme.
You do definitely have more extreme winters. I was talking to, I interviewed Charlie Lavoie. He runs a recovery podcast, The Way Out podcast. And he lives in Minnesota, and he was telling me that in Minnesota at the time we were interviewing, it was minus 20.
Why would somebody willingly live there? I just like, why would someone, like, I think about like the pioneers who were like crossing America in their covered wagons, and they're like, oh, this looks like a nice place. And then you're like covered with snow. It's like, why would you do that?
They were tough.
I don't know. I would have kept going till I hit the beach.
Yeah, okay. Me too. Yeah, I wouldn't choose to settle somewhere particularly cold, that's got to be said. But some people don't like the heat, some people don't like the cold, so maybe they were just cold loving
people.
You live
in England, which means you have a cool accent, so hands down, you're better than the Americans.
It's funny, lots of people have telling me I grew up not really liking my accent very much, and I've changed it over the years. But I like my Welsh accent now. People, particularly Americans that I'm speaking to, are telling me I've got a really cool accent, so I'm happy. I'll take that one.
The only thing I have is that like some once in a while, like my New Yorker will drop. I grew up in North Jersey, so sometimes you pick up like the New York, so I can say like water. Like that's about as exciting as it gets. Like water, I say water. Ball. Like, hey, for you, Rhea. You sound like you're in the mob. That's great.
Well, that could come in handy, being able
I
to
guess, yeah. I know a guy. I know a guy.
Oh. Well, gosh, I've got so many questions for you, but we don't have enough time to cover half of them. what if you could talk to that girl now, when you were younger, that younger girl that you were, what would you say to her if there was anything that you could go back? I mean, you wouldn't be able to go back and change,
Right.
but you know, could you go back and say something that would make her feel a bit better?
I think I would probably say it's not always going to be like this. And I would say that to me now, too.
Yes,
It's not always going to be like this.
yeah, that's good. That's really good of it. Because when you're young, you think this is it, don't you?
This is
You,
it. Yeah,
yeah.
it's not. It's not.
I'm sure that young Rio would love to, would like to hear that.
Yeah.
What things do you like to do? You said you're a writer, so obviously your creative side is really important to you, and you've got five children to look after. So I don't suppose you get an awful lot of time to yourself. But what do you do for fun? Or, you know, maybe your family is fun. What do you do to?
So what do I do for fun? I love reading. I do yoga. I love like good conversations with friends. I have one friend in particular who like we can talk and hours will go by. I like hearing people's stories. I like hearing where people are. So for me, good conversation, books, yoga, meditation, walks. I really love walking. When the weather's warm, I go out in the morning and walk with the sunshine, sunrise, and it's like that's where God is for me. When I can, when I have time and money, which is like rarely, I'll go traveling. I love to travel. And I love going to the Cape House. It's my family's house in Cape Cod. It's our happy place. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
nice. Does your dad was keeping a blog, if I remember rightly? Does he still write, or
He
was he
doesn't.
just
He
he just
doesn't.
did
No.
that
He
while your
and my
mum was
mother
ill?
kept the blog. Yeah, he and my mother kept the blog together while she was sick. And that was the only time he wrote. And it's interesting. I always thought I got my propensity for writing from my mother. She was a very creative person. She was very artistic. And she was a big reader also. But her writing was it communicated well, and was, very emotive. But my father has a talent for writing also when he allowed himself. My father's a scientist, so he would often stick to facts and figures and that kind of thing. But when he got into the emotion of it was very touching. He's a good
Wow.
writer. Yeah.
But he just did it when he had that need to, and he hasn't felt the need
Yeah,
to do it anymore.
he's not the creative type per
Yeah.
se. His creativity comes out in more like educationally. Like he studies a lot of Jewish texts. So, for him, he's achieved a lot academically in the Jewish world. So for him, that's his outlet. That's, the accumulation of knowledge and sort of that exchange of knowledge is for him kind of how he gets it.
Yeah. Oh, something popped in. Do you still go to the do you still go to your 12-step meetings
I
and still do
do.
things
I
like that?
do.
You do.
I still go to my meetings. I just actually got my 13-year coin.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was just at a meeting on Tuesday. I'm still a sponsor. I have a sponsee who I adore, and she inspires me every day. And I have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor for almost 7 years, and she's one of my best friends. And yeah, I go to the 12-step meetings in a certain group. I also go in another recovery fellowship. And these are my people. They speak my language, There's nowhere else in the world that I know people understand me as well as these people.
Oh, wonderful. It's good when you find that communication
Yeah.
and that community that really does keep you and get you and you can be yourself with those people. That's
Yeah.
fantastic. I wanted to ask in your bio, you said about how your yoga classes were sabotaged by your children. Could you tell me
Oh
about
my
that?
Okay, so through my synagogue, I offered to do a children's yoga class. So my middle and my little guy are really into yoga because they see me doing it, so they want to do it too. So my middle, I said he could be my helper. And I think he got like a little overexcited about it. And then because he was nervous about being my helper, just totally shut down and refused to do anything. And like wouldn't and like left the class and was like wandering around. And like imagine a yoga class and like somebody walking the perimeter of the classroom like while you're in a yoga. So like he's doing and I'm like trying to be like get in. I'm like trying to be like the serene yoga teacher. I'm like get on your mat. And then my baby, the little guy, my 3.5-year-old, he wanted to do what his brother was doing, and then my husband happened to pop in to grab my oldest, who decided he didn't want to be there anymore. So he starts crying because he wants to go with my husband, and I'm like, you're my kids. You're ruining my class. What are you doing? You know, like, and all the other moms with their kids. There was like one other mom there with her kids, and her kids are like, you know, like totally into it. My kids are bouncing off the walls. I'm like, clearly, I'm winning.
I tried doing a family yoga class and I had a very similar experience.
It was just, no. I prefer, even as it, when I was teaching, like as a teacher, I like teaching adults much better.
Yeah, it's much easier. Children
are challenging across the board, and when they're your own children, it's just like, they just conspire to make you insane. Like, yeah. You wake up in the morning and go, what are we going to do today to make her lose her mind?
And speaking of losing your mind with children, is your book, your parenting book, available online on Amazon?
Yeah, it's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon, is it? I'm going to have to look that up because I think if you tell these stories with the same sense of humor that you're telling the other stories of your life, I think it's going to be a brilliant read. So I'm going to have to look that up. And, I'll make sure I link to those on the show notes for this as well. I'll definitely be reading those. I think they're going to be very entertaining. who are the people in your life who inspire you the most?
So I'd say my husband, but not in the way that you would instantly think. Like, he's more the kind of person who kicks me into inspiration, because I'm very quick to be, I remember there were so many times that I'd be sitting there writing the book and looking at him and going, this is garbage. It's self-indulgent garbage and no one's going to read it. And they're going to be like, why is she talking about her stupid first world problems, whatever. And he says, okay, thank you. Now shut up and keep writing, you know? And whenever I would stop writing, he would, you know, be like, you know, you have to go and finish the book. You have to go and finish the book. To the point where last year he was working full time and he said, go work full time and finish that book. You know, he just said, go write it. And, he's my marketing guy. His design team designed the cover of the book. He made my website. He is my marketing guru. He's 100% behind this project.
Oh, wonderful.
And so that inspires me, because to have someone believe in me that much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. We all need somebody to give us that loving kick up the behind when we need a push and to support us. And that's fantastic.
It's interesting, you know, my mother was that person for me for a very long time. And when she was dying, she and my husband were having a conversation, and she said to him, you know, Rhea hurts the people that she loves the most. So, you know, now it's going to be you. And, you know, it's just, it's funny, you know, that she was that person for me, and now my husband is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm sure that he's doing a fantastic job. It sounds like he's doing a wonderful job. And it sounds like him and your mum probably got on. For him to, they got on well as well. So she would have felt safe leaving you in his hands.
100%.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Did you give me a song? Did I ask you about a song? I've been asking all my guests on the podcast to pick a song that I can link to on the show notes, because the podcast is called Sober Living Rocks, and it's a nod to my love of music and my belief in the power of music to lift us, and you know that it can touch every emotional nerve on us. So I've been asking, is there a song that you would pick to sort of lift you up when you needed a boost, or if you wanted to dance in your kitchen? Or
I'm thinking that would make me want to dance in my kitchen. Yes, Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves.
That's a great choice. That reminds me of my dancing in my bedroom when I was a little girl days.
Yeah. Oh, that song is so good. I danced with it with my kids.
Yeah.
Also, Bamboleo by the Gypsy King.
Which song?
Bamboleo by the Gypsy King.
Oh, yes, I know. Yeah. Yeah, both good dancing in the kitchen songs.
Yeah.
Oh, great. I'll put that. I've been putting like YouTube videos in the show notes, so I will
Oh,
find
awesome.
the video for walking on sunshine. And I think we should end here because we're coming up to the hour now, and this has been an amazing conversation. You've made me cry. There's not many people I've spoken to on this podcast that have actually made me cry. So I think you may actually have the honor of being the first. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
But it's been thank you so much for sharing your story. It's been
My
incredible, and
pleasure.
I really can't wait to read the book now. And
Thank
I
you.
wish you every success with that book, and I'm
Thank
sure
you.
it's going to be a great success, and you know it's going to help people as well. So thank you so much, Rhea, for joining me on the Sober Living Rocks podcast.
Thank you, Esther, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Before we go, do you want to tell the listeners how they can reach you online?
Yes, you can visit my website. It's riabochner.com, RiaBochner.com. And you'll see some of my work, and there's a link to the book on there. And you can also just search The Cape House by Ria Bochner on Amazon.
Okay, well, I will also link to those. I'll put your links and your social media links as links in the show notes as well. So check the show notes and go and buy the book because I think it's going to be an amazing read.
Thank you.
And lovely to speak to you. Thank you, Ria.
Take care.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Sober Living Rocks podcast. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You can find the show notes at soberliving.rocks/podcasts. If you like the show, please subscribe and leave a rating on iTunes and share this with your friends, as it will help me to share the message that low sober living rocks to those who need to hear it. If you have a question you would like to me to answer on the podcast, or if you would like to apply to be a guest to the show, please email me at rockcheck@soberliving.rocks. Thank you again for listening, and I will speak to you again very soon. Keep rocking. Bye.